This is 6 of 7, Part A of a Child Guidance Series done by Frank Phillips. Feel free to copy and share with others.
And during the first part of our last meeting, the matter of the training of the will. I don't know whether you have put any time in study on this subject, and as far as the book Child Guidance is concerned, but there is, besides the section on the will, a factor. I hope that you folk read this section in the book Child Guidance, beginning on page 209. It's rather a short section, only going to 214. But there are numerous references in the entire book to the will. In our last meeting, we came up to this question of when actually there is a clash of wills, you remember, and that's where we stopped, when actually this will of the child meets the will of the parent or vice versa. And we left it at that point, actually completely solving the problem, but giving some counsel on it. Now, I think that what we ought to do is to pick up from this point and go on just a little bit further, and on page 230 in the book of Child Guidance, we have a couple of statements relative to the training of the will, and I think that we'll just cover this, and then I'd like to have you discuss just a little bit more your personal opinion as to the relevancy of this particular facet of child training. But on page 230, we find the statement, the moment that the child begins to choose his own will and way, that moment his education in discipline is to begin. When is that?
What?
Pardon?
What? You meant 2 months, didn't you?
The moment that the child begins to choose his own will and way, that moment his education and discipline is to begin.
Well, that's about when you come home from the hospital.
Well, you're more nearly right this time.
Yes. I heard one was kind of joking, yet it has something too. They said start with the grandparents.
Well,
that'd be too bad.
Now, in the next paragraph, on the same page, this statement.
Oh, excuse me. Read the next sentence. So that's terrific. This may be called an unconscious education.
All right. This may be called an unconscious education.
Oh.
An unconscious education. Unconscious for who?
For the child.
For the child. Yes. Unconscious for the child, because the child is incapable of knowing what's going on. But he is not incapable of
catching on.
Well, yes, but he's not incapable of seeking his own will or showing his own will, is he? He doesn't have to even, all he's doing then is exactly what Satan is inspiring him to do and instilling in him to do.
What a terrible. Isn't it? You're taking a pick on me.
The thing that we need to understand about the will is that, well, we'll get to it here just a little bit, that this is the area where Satan actually works and works the hardest. Now, frequently, mere babies show a most determined will. Mere babies show a most determined will. If this will is not brought into subjection to a wiser authority than the child's unrestrained desires, Satan takes control of the mind and fashions and the disposition in harmony with his will. Now, what does this say to you? I mean, what does it really say?
If you don't take the first hand, that Satan will.
Start training very young.
Yeah.
We really need to get to the brass tacks, though. How do you do it with this very young baby?
All right. Now, it simply means this, that soon as this child is born, either God, through the parent, or Satan, through his own ingenious methods, which are multitudinous, will, and many times that's true, Blue, many times right through the parents. But if actually that child's will is going to be controlled, if the child is going to be reared for God, that child must be recognized as an entity that right now is being influenced either for good or bad. There's just no middle ground. That child just doesn't grow up and become a beautiful flower without some direction. Doesn't grow up and become a beautiful plant. It will become a weed, and it will have the characteristics of a weed. And this is the seriousness of this whole thing. Now listen, neglecting the work of disciplining and training until a perverse disposition has become strengthened, is doing the children a most serious wrong, for they grow up selfish, exacting, and unlovable. You've never seen any children like that, I'm sure. They cannot enjoy their own company any better than they can enjoy others. Have you ever seen children that just couldn't get along with themselves? Maybe some of us were that kind. Therefore, they will ever be filled with discontent. The work of the mother must commence at an early age, giving Satan no chance to control the minds and dispositions of their little ones. This is an area where the parent, and I realize that this seems to run counter in some respects to the message of righteousness by faith. But in reality it is not at all, because the parent stands in the place of God to the child for how long?
Till accountability.
Till the age of accountability. Therefore, you as the parent are the only ones who can really represent God to that child. You are the only ones. The child is yet incapable of actually reason, and the parents are the ones who actually have the physical contact with the child and the love for and the ability to demonstrate love to. No outside force can do this, but Satan, on the other hand, has a definite advantage. Now, why does he? Why does he have the definite advantage? Why can he work with the child and God cannot? Because only through the parent.
Because he's the father of sin. Understand?
Pardon?
Because he's the father of sin.
There's a natural infinity towards sin.
That's the point. The child is born with a natural attraction to sin. He naturally does evil. His every inclination is a natural bent to sin. Then all Satan has to do is simply create the atmosphere. And he can create it through the parents or through others, and actually strengthen simply the child, because the child has a natural inclination to do wrong, to be selfish. Selfishness is manifested in the child almost as soon as the child is born, but he's totally unconscious. Now, it's as the parent stands in the place of God that the parent must actually counteract this. Now, when we realize that God cannot work with that child until the child is capable of actually being able to think. Then we realize the position that we actually stand in as God's representative and as the, shall we say, a go-between. God must use the parent to actually reach that child. Now, when you think of it from this standpoint, we began to realize the importance of training the will, the importance that actually is connected with this whole situation. Now, in order to train that will, now we get right back to what my wife was talking about. Now, how would you begin to train the will of a little child? What do you do?
Just don't give in to him somehow.
Listen to what Mrs. White has to say here on page 213.
239.
I mean, no, 213.
Oh, I thought you were turning over me.
Your child, writing to a mother, your child needs the hand of wisdom to guide him. All right. He has been allowed to cry for what he wanted until he has formed the habit of doing this. He has been allowed to cry for his father. Again and again in his hearing, others have been told how he cries for his father until he makes it a point of doing this. Had I your child, in 3 weeks he would be transformed. This is what Mrs. White says. Had I your child, in 3 weeks he would be transformed. I would let him understand that my word was law, and kindly but firmly I would carry out my purposes. I would not submit my will to the child's will. You have a work to do here, and you've lost much by not taking hold of it before. This letter, if you read it in its entirety, is rather an interesting letter. I happen to have read this letter in its entirety, but this is not the only case. There are a number of cases where she writes to mothers who have little babies who...
But this isn't a little baby.
No,
this is not a little baby. Because
no.
It says right here, in the child's hearing, he hears others say how he's been told to cry for his father. This is a child who might be 2 years old.
Do you think that a child has to be two to...
No, not really.
Perhaps. But this isn't a little... I thought we were talking about what are we going to do right if we get here from home, right home from the hospital. What are we going to do with this baby now?
This is true. But the thing I'm pointing out is that here is that there is a solution. Mrs. White says in 3 weeks she could change this situation. 3 weeks he'd be a different child. Now, what do you suppose she'd do in 3 weeks?
With this age child, I think she'd do, it would be very clear.
She'd become herself first.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Now herself.
The very first thing she said, had I your child, would be transformed in 3 weeks. I would let him understand that my word was
law.
Now that's the first step. That's the first step. How would you do that?
Are we talking about now a newborn baby or a child of two?
Any age child.
All right, a newborn baby. Let's just, for instance, start with this little tyke that comes home from the hospital. How do we do it? I have a few ideas, but I'm not sure they're good ones. I feel like, okay, I'll go ahead and say something I'm thinking anyway. I feel like a child that young is... they haven't learned yet what results they're going to get, because they just haven't found out that anything happens from anything, because there's just infants. But I think that when a baby is that little, the only way they can express themselves is by crying. If they're wet and uncomfortable, they weep. And I feel like a mother shouldn't let a baby lie and just cry and carry on from discomfort. But I feel that if a mother goes, checks to see if the baby is wet, dries the baby, checks to see any pins sticking, no pins sticking, burps the baby so you're sure there's no gas bubbles, then it seems to me the first training is to not pick up by you know, much crying, as long as you know they're comfortable. I don't certainly don't think we ought to neglect them. Again, they just got a speech.
All right. Speech. But babies do need love and comfort. And I don't mean that every time they cry that you should pick them up and hold them forever, you know. But
just
they do many times. If you take the time to pick them up for 5 or 10 minutes and cuddle them and talk to them, that you can put them back down. And they'll be happy.
Well, you know when to pick them up. I tried it on my children. When my children were happy, it was the time I picked them up.
That's the point.
And then I put them back down. Then when they wept at another time, I would check all these little points I mentioned, and if everything was in good shape and they were fed and no other reason, then sometimes I'd let them cry a little while. But I don't believe that a healthy, loved child, a little infant, is going to weep for any very long length of time unless they have been spoiled.
But
I don't believe that they do, unless they're spoiled.
If a child is picked up when it isn't crying, it doesn't make the connection then between the crying and the soothing that it gets from crying or the results, because the only thing that a child learns by is the cause and effect. A child begins to cry.
Oh, but grandmothers, this is where grandparents are just ruined. Not us, of course, but... grandparents that will come in and pick them up. I tell you, I was terrible to my mother. When my mother came, she's only been in my home one time, that's probably why, maybe. But she came in and she wanted to pick up this baby every time it cried. And I was reading the book, how you're supposed to do it, and I'm not going to do that. And I told her, no, you can't pick up the baby. She thought that was the most murderous thing anybody ever did. But I let her pick it up other times, but you know, every time it cried, it didn't get picked up. So grandparents are pretty awful.
Yeah. There are problems. But this is the early beginning and about the only approach. Now then, when a child is older, you face exactly what we discussed last Sunday night, when there is a clash of wills. Because if the child has developed a self-will, you're going to have a clash of wills. And that's just... But in order to avoid this as much as possible, if you were to take an obstreperous child that actually has developed a strong will and you wanted to actually transform that child, how would you go about it? What would you do?
If you're forced, just use a heavier rod.
No force, but just a heavier rod. Luther, that's very...
I think appetite comes in here. I think when children begin to grow at all and they catch on to the eating bit, that some parents make food a solo. Some parents let them, every time they cry, they stuff something in their mouth, bottle or otherwise. I feel like that children learn this power of the appetite and this lack of control of eating. This is where it begins in children, and this is where this... has so much to say about what this does to the character. I think that's one place that we can be...
All right. Then you'd say we first of all would check the habit patterns of whom?
Myself. Of the parents first. Because you know what? The last couple of weeks or couple of days or 3 or 4 days, I've been very careful about what I eat. Now I find out what you say is true. My mind is even a little bit clearer. I don't feel so...
sluggish?
So what? I don't know what...
The simple fact that habit patterns are the very important, and we go right back to habit patterns. And check out the habit patterns. Are we in our habit patterns, are we promoting this will, this stubborn will?
We should be.
And we need to check on this.
Of course, if you're in the middle of a crisis, we're speaking, now here we are in a crisis, the child's will pitted against mine.
No.
Oh, I
think no, we're just now under the job. We have the responsibility of actually changing a child's strong will. Now, how do we do it?
But we're not in the middle of a crisis.
No, we're not.
In the middle of a crisis, it would be different than what we're doing now.
We are face to face with the fact now that we've learned that the will needs to be brought under control, and the child needs to submit that will to the parent. And maybe it's a four-year-old child, or a five or six, or whatever it is. And actually, we've learned that it needs to submit that will. It has not done this. The child has been, it's been pretty much me forcing the child and so forth all the way along. Now, how would I go about changing the whole pattern so that the child's will would be actually given, submitted to the parent?
Well, I think at that age you talk.
Yes, many times when a crisis will come up, a youngster will, they have been used to getting their own way by this fussing or whatever kind of a show they're putting on. And if you just tell them, say, now listen, I can't allow you to form a character by getting what you want from this kind of action. And you might as well quit now because
no results.
Yeah, because this can't work. And if you explain that to them and they realize that you mean it,
then
it's the battle's won. Because they realize that you have it thought out and they're not going to buffalo
you. You are one jump ahead of them, in other words.
All right.
Consistency is the word, isn't it?
All right, Luther?
In the way we presented this particular case, I think you're indicating that I just now found out that I haven't handled this, obviously, in the last, or he wouldn't have this will problem.
All right.
So
that's right.
If he's old enough to hear and understand any kind of words, this may not be right, but the way I would handle it would be to, before there comes a time when the will be implied, just to sit down and tell him, guess what? Dad's learned this new concept in raising kids, and you're one of them.
You're my victim.
and this is the way that it's going to be, and I'm going to ask that you abide by it. And if you don't, it's going to be rather unpleasant for you, you know.
And then live up to it.
Yes.
All right. Now, I'd like to hear from some of you on this, because I think that right here, there's no use in having a child guidance class unless actually we come up with some practical answers as to how to actually accomplish the thing.
Several hands up.
All right.
I wanted to say one thing. She says here she could do it in 3 weeks with a child. You can probably do this faster with a strange child than you can with your own, because your own habit patterns, that child knows how to make you flub up on your own old habit patterns. Pretty good.
That's a cop-out.
I mean, if he's tricked you, devil's you, then to trick you.
You're wrong.
But it could take longer than with the
old. It could. Mrs. Zegley has her hand.
All right, Mrs. Zegley.
Is it possible that many of our problems arise because of this lack of consistency?
Yes.
We have our crisis comes because they've gotten away with it.
Yeah, try it again. Right. Worked once, might work twice.
Or that we have possibly asked something of them that is ridiculous. You know, tell them you can't have cookies, but put the cookie jar out on the floor.
Yeah. All right. Now, here is that. Here, I think you'll find is the basic foundation that you'll find in child guidance. The very first place, a parent who is going to attempt to make this transition needs to sit down and analyze, when do these crisis periods come? What precipitates them? Is it a haphazard pattern, or do these happen at mealtime? Do they happen at playtime? Do they happen, you say, these times? Then actually honestly analyze, do these happen whenever I give a command? When do these happen? Or do they happen when my child actually is cranky and wants something,
tired?
Analyze this whole thing. Mrs. White says that if it's at all possible to avoid a confrontation, that is not the way to solve the problem. It is never solved by stern, hard, cold approach to the thing. It must be that actually I must realize that the child is that way because of what?
Because of what you have done.
Because I have made him that way.
So
I have permitted him to be that way. He, after all, inherited what he has from me. So I do bear some responsibility, and if I look at it from that standpoint, then I'm going to approach this thing and try and approach it from an intelligent standpoint. So I sit down and actually analyze this thing and say, when does my child display this kind of an attitude? If it's a temper tantrum that he has, what precipitates this? What brings it on? And then to actually avoid this and to bring about the change so that the child finds that there is more pleasure in actually obedience than in disobedience. Now, that doesn't come in a moment. That is the slow process, and Mrs. White says that it would take 3 weeks to do it, of consistent effort as far as that's concerned. But, pardon?
With that
one. Yes, with this child.
Yes.
That's right.
That's right.
It may take longer with some other child.
Can I make a speech right here?
Yeah.
I'm thinking of a mother we had in Corvallis, something that I think really helps with children, problem children. This child was probably about as monstrous as for a two-year-old as anything I ever saw. Just an absolute disaster if the child ever came to your home and came into the church each Sabbath. Just really awful. Parents, both highly educated, PhDs and all these things. And every time I would be around that mother, and she'd be with other young mothers, and they'd be discussing their children, or even when they weren't discussing children, she'd say, oh, I just can't do a thing with him. I won't name his name because you might know who it is. Just can't do a thing with him. And no matter what I do, he does so-and-so, and on, and here he is, 2 years old, and believe, sharp as a tack. He has these bright parents, and he took after him. He's very bright, really brighter than they are, I think. And just on and on about how he just goes into these temper fits. He does this, just raving about his bad qualities. And one time, I got to be a good friend of hers, and so I felt free to talk with her about it. She had asked me, what am I going to do with this child? So I took the opportunity to suggest to her that maybe if in the future when she was with us all and the young women in the church get together, instead of saying this, to just say, I'm so proud of little Tootsie because today he has been so obedient, or anything, you know, anything that she can possibly say that is good about this little tyke. And I tell you, I think this has a tremendous influence on even little children, to tell the good things that they do and to never mention, oh, he always does it, always does. I can't do a thing with him. Well, okay, if you can't do a thing with me, I'll share a fiction.
All right. Yeah. That's a good idea. Now, let me just make a
suggestion. Two hands went
up. Phyllis?
I had just previously been wanting to make the same observation. I think Mrs. White's statement here that we shouldn't talk in front of our children about them.
Absolutely.
Cannot be stressed enough.
Correct.
I've noticed particularly in the last 2 weeks, just two or three things that I have talked about my children in front of them. You know, just disaster.
They live up to it.
Magnifies it right away.
They're
so quick to pick it up. Somebody else that
Blue? Well, with, you know, this instance of when we do something to bring on our child's, you know, problem. Like, for instance, if Twyla, Mamie, gets that sort of upset when she doesn't get enough rest. Now, if I do something, like if I go to prayer meeting and the next day she's extra tired, now how do I handle this the next day? It's not her fault, it's mine.
Well, we have to learn self-control, though, my dear.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to be tired all my life. I'm going to be tired all my life. I'm going to often be too tired. And we have to learn early in life
that
even though we're weary, we behave ourselves somewhat.
Well, now let's take these things one at a time. Suppose that I, in analyzing, I discover that my child, I have somewhat of a little buzzsaw on my hands every time I command him to do something.
Oh, let's stop commanding then.
Every time I command him to do something, there's a hazard on the road.
Okay, here's
catastrophe. And now, don't you answer all the questions. I want to know here. Now, what do I do? What do I do? Every time I ask him to do something, he just throws a fit.
Maybe you have to do it in different ways.
I can't answer.
Maybe
you
spit up and some good.
No, tell us about it.
I don't necessarily think we should always tease and humor children into obeying. Sometimes they should obey just because we tell them to.
Because
we
don't
always make
so.
Obeying just fun and games either.
But I can't talk, huh?
No, you can't. Boy, this is a real advantage.
You just wait.
Well, I am usually, you know, going to please do this, but I think
never.
If they don't, then that we have to.
I don't think you should ever do that. You're not supposed to talk.
Don't you ever think you should say please do this?
No, I don't think you say, will you do it?
What do you say? Go vacuum? That sounds awful fun.
No. But I just say, it's time to do the vacuuming.
Mother, we need some discussion.
I know it.
I want to know what really are we going to do with a situation like this?
Well, I guess I agree. I think that when I say, please set the table for me, that's fine. And she does it.
That isn't what I understood you to say, Wanda. I wouldn't have disagreed. I thought you said, will you please set the table?
Well, maybe I didn't
say that, but
she feels like that usually. And if she doesn't, well, then there comes a little bit of
commanding. All right. Must be the remainder.
For one thing, she wants to
sit.
Thank you.
Why would a child be prepared when you can't ask them to do so? I mean, there must be a reason that you feel good either because it doesn't seem good.
Will. Obstreperous will.
They don't want to be commanded.
Vossi right. Had her hand up.
Who?
Vossi.
Vossi, you're too close.
Why don't you ask them? I mean,
See, I'm going to have to make a speech before you can help them.
You got yourself into this. Get yourself out.
Two more hands.
All right, Luther.
I was going to answer the question for Dorothy.
Oh, okay. she's the, perfectly.
The question was, why don't we ask them to do it? Because, and I assume we're still talking at this tender age where we are wanting to let them know that what we say is law, and when we ask them, will you? It immediately gives them a choice to say, well, maybe I won't, see? And even though they don't say it, they'll think it. Just wait till I get big enough, and I will be. I'll make my choice.
Somebody else had their hand back here.
Yes.
Something new that just it popped in our household, and I get to kind of snuck in, because Don and I just realized it. When we ask our son to do something, and he's five, he comes up with the good excuse, I got the problem.
This shows a degree.
No, it can't be everything. There's time.
Shows certainly a great degree of intelligence.
But the job is still there afterwards.
I think Vossi had her hand up again.
Vossi?
Well, I ask my children to do something, but while I'm asking them to do it, I also tell them what will happen if they don't.
All right. My shins are going to be worn out if she doesn't get a chance to say this. So. Go ahead. What is it?
No, I think instead of saying, I'm speaking of little children.
How little?
Oh. Little.
2, 3, 4.
12 and little?
No.
Oh.
I don't. Well, I mean, you can use the same technique on 12, but I'm thinking of little children rather than saying. Will you, now, what is the little chore? Will you go carry the wood in? Since we don't have any wood, that isn't a very good one. But anyway, I think, just like Luther said there, it gives them a chance to, I have a choice here. I don't know whether I will or whether I won't. And so it isn't, there's this question of obedience. And it seems to me, neither do I command them, go get in the wood. I mean, that I'd be crude and rude, and just the opposite of what I'd wanting to train my child to be. I want my child to be courteous. And so I feel like if I would say something like, in fact, I'm a great believer in our camp work, when we were in youth work, in our summer camp work, we tried to do everything we possibly could by the fun method, make it a joy to do. And I know that Vossi's grandmother, when her little girl was little and when my little girl was little, she would, as she did her housework around, it was time to make the bed. Oh, goody goody, it's time to make the bed. She had a little song about this is the way we make the bed. And when it came time to do that, why, her little girl was delighted to make the bed, and so was my little girl delighted to make the bed, because this was a gay, happy thing. There are times when you don't have time to sing your little song, but I think if the mother's spirit is one of happiness and pleasure in the work that's to be done, it greatly helps the child. But if there comes a time when it must be done and you can't think of a song or something, then I think you could say something like, It's time now for the word to be gotten in. I know you're going to do it real fast today. Yesterday you did it real well. Today you're going to do it even better. Mother's so proud of you the way you bring the wood in. I don't. There's no choice. The wood's going to be brought in. I'm not commanding. I'm not being ornery about it. The child wants to do it.
But you see, that's little. And twelve is not little. So what do I do with 12 now?
Well. Well, let's come to that a little bit later.
Why?
All right. All right.
Yeah,
trial.
Right.
All right, like doing the dishes.
Yeah.
All right, Luther's got the answer.
Well, make her part of your family.
I try.
Yeah, but let her feel it. You talk to her and say, well, now, there's several things that we want to get done.
That's right.
We want to do this. We're going to vacuum, and then we're going to clean up the kitchen. And I want to make sure that there's some time to play with you on this project of yours. Yeah. So let's do it in this order, and let's go do it. And boy, that'll keep getting.
Do we give her a choice of what she wants to do?
No.
Oh no.
Oh. You might give. Could you, what about a choice in the order that she wants to do?
Well, like I say, now say if we're doing it together, okay. And I say, well, she's got to do one or I got to do the other.
Make sure.
Do I ask her, would you like to do this or would you rather vacuum?
Look at now. Make sure that always in any decision making of a child that you do not frustrate the character building.
Right.
The thing we're doing is building character. They still need to train the will. We're in the process of training the will, not breaking the will. So the decisions that a child makes should never be decisions that are character building or destroying, obviously. They will be building character, but they are not obvious questions or value decisions, but decisions that, which color dress, you know, do you want to wear the green one or the blue one? This is training them to use the choice, the power of choice, but it really isn't going to make any difference about their character whether they choose the blue one or the green one. Did I say whatever color I said? Anyway, yeah, this doesn't matter, you see. And it doesn't matter to you see. But if you give them a choice between vacuuming and doing the dishes, make sure that it doesn't matter to you which way they're going to go. If they say, all right, I'll do the dishes, make sure that that's perfectly all right, you see, and that it isn't going to actually cause any fuss in any way.
Then you don't
have a right
to do that.
Certainly.
And besides, this is why it does mention that we work with our children. Sometimes I think we've got the idea that somehow we're going to make this miserable and they suffer through. I think children often love to work with mother.
No, the thing that actually...
She has her hand up.
Excuse me.
What if you're trying to spread yourself among four or five people? That's my biggest frustration.
When you get a child's will actually going with yours, you don't have to be worried. I mean, it's not going to take all your time. In fact, it's a great time saver. When you have four or five obstreperous ones, it does take all your time. But if you get them so that they're working with you, it's an entirely different picture. Now, on page 31, she says, the work of parents is seldom done as it should be. Now, that includes quite a bit. It's seldom done as it should be. Parents, have you studied parental government that you may wisely train the will and impulse of your child? Now, we've studied the will. Now, what does she mean by impulse? She means immediate reaction.
The habitual reaction.
You see, the immediate reaction of a child. And this is where wise counseling and wise training must come in so that you do not give the opportunity for immediate response that is aggravated response. Therefore, she goes on here and she says, teach the young tendrils to entwine about God for support. It is not enough to say, do this or do that, and then become utterly regardless and forgetful of what you have required. And this is where we come back to what?
Consistency.
And the children are not careful to do your commands. Prepare the way for your child to obey commands cheerfully. Prepare the way for them to actually obey your commands cheerfully. Teach the tendrils to cling to Jesus. Now, what's she talking about? Clinging to parents. So it is a matter of getting the child to want to cooperate with you, because that's clinging to Jesus. The child, the parent stands in the place of Jesus to the child. So the child must want to actually cooperate with the parent. teach them to ask the Lord to help them in the little things of life, to be wide awake, to see the small duties which need to be done, to be helpful in the home. If you do not educate them, there is one who will. For Satan is watching his opportunity to sow the seeds of tares in the heart. Now, when we think of actually this matter of training this will, and we are in the process here of actually knowing how to do this thing, when we are trying to teach the child to cooperate, we want to frame our commands in a way that does not actually irritate and does not give an opportunity for choice either way. When I say do this or get at that, you know, and I make a command of this kind, immediately the immediate impulse is resistance, isn't it?
Yes.
Nobody likes to be told get out there and get that job done. That isn't the way to do it. But what would you say in place of this? How would you frame a command?
Well, I tried to frame a command here. I don't know if anybody heard it, shall I say it again? Of how I think it ought to be framed. You know,
it's time to vacuum the closet.
Well, it seems like there's... I agreed with what you were saying, but I was wondering if it couldn't be done in a shorter way, too.
It could be done in a shorter way.
In other words, do we have to bribe the child?
I'm not bribing the child.
Well, with praise for what he's done yesterday.
No, we don't have to. That's just one way. I mean, there could be other ways of doing it, and with the same spirit, though, that brings cooperation. No, we don't have to. We don't have to. However, I'll tell you, you can't go too far wrong to praise honest, good effort.
And well, the thing is that really inherently in every small child and in every child, I don't care what age it is until they get to a teenage, there's a breakover in a child when they get to the point where actually they are passing the junior level. And here is where the real breakover actually occurs. Up until the time a child enters early teens, and it's this breakover point is getting less and less and less every year, because children are maturing more quickly, more earlier all the time. But until that time occurs, there is inherently in every child a real desire to please. Now, this is you may not have developed this, but it is inherently there. It is always there. We've had many experiences of this kind. Children that are rebellious and obstreperous, but who still want to please, but actually many of these children find that they cannot really please.
Some parents.
The parents will ask them to do something, they'll do it, and the parent, it never satisfies.
Right.
It just doesn't satisfy. Yes, ma'am.
I think you find this along the way, where they feel you're really counting on them, and they have the feeling that you're expecting to do something, and it means a lot to you if they don't want to let you down.
Well, this is true.
Right.
But now, the thing that actually is most important is to capitalize upon this inherent capacity that a child has to please, and to let them know that you have decided it is your desire that they do a certain thing. Mary, I have decided that now I want you to do this, you say. You don't give them a command that is just without a purpose. They want to do this then because you want them to do it. Now, this may not be an immediate response that they would get, but the thing is that this thing generates in a child and satisfies the child, because the child actually is doing what you want them to do, not because it is just simply an arbitrary thing on your part. Because this builds the impulse of resistance. If you're just simply asking the child to do jobs that are just, you know, un, pleasant and just jobs that are something you don't want to do in any sense of the word, you don't want to participate with them, they naturally have this. But to start with actually anything that you've had a problem with in giving commands and reframe these from the standpoint of the fact that this is what Mother wants you to do.
Could you say Mother and really appreciates your help?
Sure.
Mother appreciates how good you work with her, and you know, like
you can help the child by letting them know that you do appreciate their help, and this is what I'd like to have you do now. Something of this kind.
Is it? I've always got the feeling, since we've been learning about self, that if you tell a child that his work is good, it's making him think of, no, maybe I've got the wrong impression.
You surely have.
This is...
You've gotten the wrong impression.
Don't you work better if your boss comes around and says, "Say, I certainly appreciate what you did today."
Oh, sure. You know, when
I thought maybe if
apply.
I tell him it's a twilight, make him think of something.
No, when you go... When we
you
want to
build the good self image,
right,
but not the bad. That's
okay,
the point.
When we used to go and visit our grandchildren, our daughter would say, "Now everything on the table here, the kids just 8 and 9 years old." She'd say, "Corinne baked the bread, Donnell baked the whatever, somebody else made the salad." She made them feel so good that, because we were so pleased. And, you know, kids, we need to give them credit for what they do.
I didn't know.
And it doesn't build self. That doesn't build self.
Mrs. Ziegler, you had your hand.
Self-respect.
One first grade teacher did all of her discipline by praising one person.
Absolutely.
You know, such Johnny is certainly sitting there, like, "Oh, I don't think it's Johnny."
Mm-hmm.
And this type of thing. And I was very pleased when my children did the same thing with taking out the garbage. I say this because they are this way all the time. But evidently, I had praised them. I had talked about it to their father, how very much I'd appreciated this.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know that I cannot step out the back door, but what both of them have gone to get away from the TMT, even without me.
That is the truth.
Only because they're dying to be praised.
Well, they're not only
just
dying
like
to be praised, but they're dying to please you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And we need to capitalize upon the natural tendencies that all children have. And this is why she says study. You see, study how to govern both the will and the impulse. If I'm going to just simply force my way so that the impulse, the child has to overcome this impulse, this reactionary impulse, then I'm in a problem before I ever open my mouth. If all my commands irritate, it just simply is a matter of one force against another. Jackie.
Oh, and there's two things. First, I think there's a real tendency, and I've been guilty of this in the past, is of, you know, when a child does what you ask, of just, you know, that's fine, and kind of overlooking it. And when they don't, then, you know, dwelling on the negative.
You notice them.
Correct.
And secondly, in answer to Melissa, I've given a lot of thought to this. And I think that, I don't know, there's a technique that I use with Troy. When he does something right, now I praise him, but I say things like, "Jesus must be in Tori's heart today because he's done such and such." So he's getting the praise, but yet, you know, the credit's really going to the Lord.
Correct.
That's very good.
And I think a lot of the things we say is like this.
That's right. That they know that's where the Lord, that certainly is good.
How true this is. Always, this is a part of what she has to say here on page 31. Actually, prepare the way for your child to obey your commands cheerfully. Teach the tendrils to cling to Jesus. Teach them to ask the Lord to help them in the little things of life. And this is exactly what you're doing.
Jesus in the actions of the
little
things of life.
Correct.
That's
correct.
Right.
And this is exactly what it ought to be. Exactly what it ought to be. Always.
Would that be the same thing as when they come and think they say, "Isn't this good?" And you would say, "Sure, it's pretty."
I'd say, "Sure, it's pretty." Jesus has given you a real talent. Now, if you'll just use it for Him. We have a granddaughter that's very talented musically. I never tell her how great she is musically, but I tell her the Lord is really going to find something for you to do for Him with your talent.
Yeah, that's good. I need it to know that.
On page 213. She says, a great mistake is made when the line of control lines of control are placed in the child's hands, and he is allowed to bear sway and control in the home. This is giving undue direction to that wonderful thing, the willpower. But this has been done and will continue to be done because fathers and mothers are blind to their discernment and calculation. They are blind in their discernment and calculation. Now, the thing that the only reason we've spent as much time as we have, and I know that we've got to go on, but this matter of the will, training of the will, is the whole of successfully rearing children. It is the whole of the whole program. If the will is in the hands of the parent, you just don't have any problems. And you could put in all of the time studying this one subject, and you would be absolutely just profiting constantly by actually. Mrs. White has, in talking in various places here, she talks about the arbitrary will. She talks about the will and the impulse on page 31. On page 169, the will and passions, self-will and pride. She talks about the will from the very cradle, manifested in the child from the very cradle. She talks about forcing the will, the determined will, the will and school, the indomitable will, the exercise of the will. She talks about the using the child's will in a positive way. Happiness. And she says that a child can only be happy if their will is subdued or submitted to the parents. They just can't be happy unless it's true. And this is absolutely a fact. A child who is left to manifest his own obstreperous will is an unhappy child always. An unhappy child with himself, he's unhappy with others, he's unhappy just all the time. She talks about parents under Christ, asking the child in the proper way. That is, this is just what we were talking about here. How do you actually ask a child? Page 281, in case you want to read it there. Character and the will. She talks about the will and the problems that come in governing the will when the health of the child is not good. In other words, am I fostering a willfulness in the child by giving him an improper diet? It is very, very important. If a child is fed, as my wife said, if a child has been used to actually getting what they want to eat whenever they fuss, this not alone damages the will, but destroys the health, so that the will, it becomes absolutely more warped all the time. And it's not the child's fault. It's the parents' fault. That's why Mrs. White says every morsel of food of any kind taken between meals is a sin. And that's a pretty strong statement. How many times have you ever confessed that to the Lord that you ate some food between meals? I mean, recognize it as sin. I mean, this is strong medicine, but it is an absolute fact. And we still go on and piecemeal or
piecing between meals.
That's right. We still go on and satisfy their whims, and every time a child begins to fuss, well, you know, just satisfy it. This is our fault, not the child's fault. She talks about self-abuse destroying the will completely. Completely destroying the will. The child has, if we do not recognize, and yet today, psychiatrists and psychologists will tell you this is a perfectly normal thing. Don't worry about it. If a child begins in the process of self-abuse, I've had many of them say, don't worry about it at all, that'll all straighten out. Just there. That's a perfectly normal thing. And do you know what? They're telling the absolute truth. It is a perfectly normal thing. But the problem is that we are not trying to raise normal children in the norm of this world. We are wanting to raise an entirely different child, a child that doesn't have the normal natural disposition and the normal natural tendencies. The norm of this world is satanically controlled, and self-abuse, masturbation of any kind is the norm that Satan puts in. Now that's just as plain and simple as it can be. And you can expect it unless you, as a parent, represent God and take this seriously.
You know, we have a question.
Because it will definitely happen. And
we have a question.
If you want to read
that.
On that, read page 245 and 445 and 446 in here. Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, a minute amount. Mrs. White has just a voluminous amount written on this subject.
Well, somebody put a question in on that, and we're going to cover that in one of our questions.
Okay.
Not tonight.
If I ever get through. All right, she talks about along in the same page 452 on morality and the will. But she goes so far here in this matter of self-abuse as talking in here in child guidance of an adult man whose will is completely destroyed through nothing but self-abuse.
And also...
And it may surprise you, but...
That can come from your diet.
Well, there's a tremendous amount. And we, as far as diet is concerned, she has in many of varied places, she speaks definitely of the diet affecting the morality and the matter of the passions. She talks about the will and the passion, page 169. She talks about the will as it is manifested in parents as being often Satan's voice. That's kind of an interesting thing. Rather than the voice of the parent, the true voice of the parent. Our time for this is gone. I suppose we'll have to move on to another subject next week, but I can't stress this enough. I can't place possibly enough importance upon this particular subject. I wish we had time to take every problem that arises where there is a resistance and actually analyze it and come up with some profitable suggestions on it. But, yes, Mrs.
When we have handled it wrong now, and we do have two of us standing here, bold-faced at each other, you know, who's going to win, what do you do?
Well...
obviously have mishandled it, or it never would have arisen.
Well, on page 211, Mrs. White has a whole section in here, a large paragraph, or... large section with several paragraphs, when there is a clash of wills begins. And we went over this last week.
Okay.
But she has a number of things. Great care should be shown to avoid such an issue, but once such an issue is entered into, the child must be led to yield to the superior wisdom of the parent. Must be led to yield. Remember that anyone who is forced to yield has never really yielded. Yielding is an act of the will. And a child that is forced to yield, you get the exterior obedience, but you do not get the yielding. You do not get the surrender. And there are many, many, many times that this occurs. She says nothing is to be done that will develop a defiant spirit in the child. Now this is getting back to the impulse. Educate to actually train the will and the impulse. don't let that child have to, every time you speak to it, resist the impulse to fight back. Just don't do it. Change your command so that there is not a resistance, but rather a question in the child's mind. Well, that's what mother wants me to do. That's what dad wants me to do. Now, this goes on here, and it tells you here, when there is this total resistance, you don't have to solve it right in a moment.
This is what I was wondering. If at that moment we are impressed by the Holy Spirit that, oh, you're really in the wrong place, you know, you've done it wrong, you know, and so, but what does this do to the child when we realize we've done something wrong? Do we correct it?
All right.
And maybe even ask the children's forgiveness?
Mm-hmm. We covered it on a night when you weren't here.
Okay, we sure do. Okay, well then let's
not. I'll honestly
take it.
No, I didn't mean to, but we did.
It's a very interesting program that she outlines here, and this isn't the only place, but this
okay,
is
well,
her.
Don't take
okay.
More time now.
Yes. Chuck, we must.
If possible, we could avoid some of these clashes. In other words, if we haven't been particularly really pleasant before we come along to these command type, or, you know, come along to commanding the child to do something, we might be able to then turn on the smiles and turn on the sweet voice and the proper command and not get the desired results because of what's gone on prior.
Because we haven't been humble.
Right.
All right, dear.
Okay.
I'll have to relinquish my.
Okay, I tell you, just right on this subject, I just happened to turn to this, and it looks to me so encouraging. And it's on page 256 in Child Guidance, and she says, "After you have done your duty faithfully to your children, then carry them to God and ask Him to help you. Tell Him that you have done your part, and then in faith ask God to do His part, that which you cannot do. Ask Him to temper their dispositions, to make them mild and gentle by His Holy Spirit. He will hear you pray. He will love to answer your prayers. Through His word, He has enjoined it upon you to correct your children, to spare not for their crying, and His word is to be heeded in these things." I thought that was a real encouraging thought for us. I'm going to read something clear off the subject now, but I have read it in a Fascinating Womanhood class, but the men weren't there. So this is particularly directed to mothers, but I think it is really, I like it. It's entitled, "I Dreamed." "I dreamed of being a missionary in foreign places, bringing great numbers of swarthy-faced souls to God, but God gave me the dirty faces of my own children. I dreamed of being a nurse, but God made me a scrub woman, a kitchen maid, a washer of greasy dishes, dirty clothes, and smeared windows. I dreamed of being musically trained, but God gave me the noise of crying babies and the clamor of quarreling boys. I dreamed of being a landscape artist, but God gave me a kitchen window to look out of and diapers to hang against the summer sky. I dreamed of writing poems, but God gave me baby records to keep, excuse blanks to fill out, report cards to sign. I dreamed of being a teacher, but God chose to let me learn the hard way through the discipline of daily household chores, through the restriction of freedom to come and go as I wish, through the confines of an ever-tight budget. I dreamed of being faithful in great things, but God asked me to be faithful in little things, tying shoes, wiping noses, putting wheels on tiny trucks, getting that one more drink of water, applying band-aids, answering questions, scraping clay from the floor, making kites, removing gum from blonde hair. I dreamed of being a saint, but God gave me boys, and so it was that my dreams died. Or did they? Ah, rather, I should say, so it was that my dreams became realities, for I am a missionary. In my keeping are living souls, no less precious to God than the souls of the Indians and the Africans that I hope to win. From me, they can best learn the strength of love, the power of prayer, and the efficacy of a strong faith in Christ." I thought that was really meaningful to a mother. Before we start our questions, I wanted to announce that we do have the books now, the big supply of Life of Victory and His Cross and Mine, and I have some here tonight. They are $2 a piece, and I'll be glad to sell some to you. Do you want to say anything about them?
Well, I would just like to say that these are companion books in reality, and are just probably this book, His Cross and Mine. These are books that have been out of print for many, many, many years. But these books, when studied and read together, these books will give you a concept of the spiritual side and the spiritual life that is so necessary to have if honestly we are going to be successful in understanding the practicality of training and working with our children. Because there is no way that actually the religion that you want your child to grow up loving, there's no way that that child can grow up loving God without understanding righteousness by faith.
And unless we know that.
And unless this becomes a part of your own life. And I mean an integral part. And these are the two finest books that I know of.
Outside of the Spirit of Prophecy.
Yes, outside of the Spirit of Prophecy. But they're just invaluable. Just invaluable. His Cross and Mine and The Life of Victory, both by Elder Meade McGuire, long since deceased. But we were very, very fortunate in getting 1,000 of each of those. So we have them.
Okay, first question. Still one left in the section on discipline, and I think we've pretty well covered this in just in our discussion here. How do we handle a strong-willed child? Some do not respond so readily to suggestions. I think we pretty well covered consistency and, you know, practice of justice and mercy. Probably not a lot more to say on that. All right, the next question. Someone wants us to discuss a child's physical development, health, diet, and so forth. And I tell you, in this book, Child Guidance, there's really some good counsel on that. I'm going to just read two or three excerpts and then we'll discuss it too. From the first dawn of reason, the human mind should become intelligent in regard to the physical structure. The first study of the young should be to know themselves and how to keep their bodies in health. If parents themselves would obtain knowledge and feel the importance of putting it to a practical use in the education of their dear children, we should see a different order of things among children and youth. They should be instructed in regard to their own bodies. There are but few youth who have any definite knowledge of the mysteries of human life. They know but little about the living machinery. Teach your children to study from cause to effect. Show them that if they violate the laws of their being, they must pay the penalty by suffering disease. If in your efforts you can see no special improvement, be not discouraged. Patiently instruct, line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little and there a little. Continue to teach your children in regard to their own bodies and how to take care of them. And she says, physical training, the development of the body, is far more easily given than spiritual training. The nursery, the playground, the workshop, the sowing of the seed, and the gathering of the harvest, all these give physical training. Under ordinary favorable circumstances, a child naturally gains healthful vigor and a proper development of the bodily organs. Yet even in physical lines, the child should be carefully trained. Our children should be instructed that they may be intelligent in regard to their own physical organism. They can at an early age, by patient instruction, be made to understand that they should be made to obey the laws of their being if they would be free from pain and disease, and so on. And let's see, there's another one here I wanted to mention that is so good on that. By the way, on next Sabbath, we're having a discussion, a Sabbath afternoon discussion period, and we had at one time asked people to put in, you know, what they'd like to see us discuss, and one of the things that someone had put in, they'd like to have discussed, is the health reform message relevant to this time, and that happens to be what we're going to have discussed next Sabbath afternoon at 4 o'clock, so we won't do, you know, most of you probably will come, so we won't do a lot on this tonight, but...
I think, though, that we ought to make clear when we're talking about health reform here, or health principles, that we're talking about as far as children are concerned, we're talking about cleanliness, we're talking about appetite. When it comes to the entire health program, parents cannot teach the health principles to a child unless they really practice them.
That's right.
Just can't do it.
That's right.
And appetite is probably the greatest offender. This is where we offend it. Now, appetite isn't any more important than other aspects of healthful living. The 7-point program that Mrs. White gives to us is absolutely fundamental and must be the foundation of the health principles of your own home. And if it is, then it is perfectly natural for a child to desire, because he sees the results
and if we make it
in his own life.